Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. This is going to be fun. I think we might be talking about some neuroscience today and maybe some stress and some burnout, some disengagement. And maybe we'll be talking about other things that are much more esoteric than that. Let's see. welcome to the podcast, Maria.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I always get the first and sometimes the more difficult question out of the way first. And so I'm going to do that today as well. Who are you, Maria Hago?
That is a difficult question. One that we often avoid, I presume. Who am I? Well, I think I'm driven by a deep sense of curiosity for human behavior, for life as a positive experience. I'm originally from Sweden, just as a sort of nationality or geographical location. but I've lived in 10 different cities, in 7 different countries and 3 different continents. So over the last 35 years, I've been on this journey of the world, in a sense, of observing, learning, adapting to the differences that we have, and probably more interestingly, learning about the similarities that we have. I live in Dubai. I'm married to a Swiss Pakistani. So I am a very sort of globally absorbed human. But I think innately I'm driven by curiosity, knowledge, learning, sort of searching for resolving part of the human condition of chronic dissatisfaction, I'm sort of on a mission, which I suppose is driven by who I am, to help people to resolve some of their own stories, some of their own mindsets, in order to be able to live a life well lived, in order to release some of that sort of tension and pressure and expectations. And this journey took me on many different paths of exploration. And more recently, let's say in the last 5 years or so, to the brain, which somehow feels to me like a bit of a foundation of some of the challenges that we face. Although I try not to define too much, because there's so many aspects, right, of being human, but certainly the brain seems to be quite a good foundation of trying to understand the human condition a little bit further, trying to understand some of our challenges, some of the things that hold us back, our perspectives, etc., which then led me to do studies in neuroscience and psychology, specifically around mental health. So I'm deeply curious about that. I'm deeply curious about what drives our behavior, our relationships, which ultimately become the story of our lives, right? How we behave, how we build connection and relationships becomes our life. Becomes the quality of our life and how we live it. I'm fascinated by learning. I'm fascinated by creativity and curiosity and of what it feels to live a human life, the spiritual connection of being human. I'm sort of half science, half intuition. The sort of the understanding and then the knowing, you know, like both of those, which are very conflicting worlds. I remember when I was writing my thesis for my master's, of course, in the science topic and having to remain very evidence-based and research-based and sort of struggling to stay on that path because I wanted to also bring in, well, we know because we can feel, which is not really widely accepted in the science community, you know, for obvious reasons, and fair enough, you know, it's a different approach. But I think I am someone who's kind of torn between those two, or maybe not torn, but someone who tries to live collectively within those two worlds, and how they can kind of interconnect. But yeah, it's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, where do you start? Where do you stop talking about who am I? but I think that sort of gives a little bit of a summary of part of my journey in life and what drives me, which is what makes me me.
I have such a deep curiosity around the relationship building. You said something that how we build connection and relationship becomes our lives. And then especially I'm curious about that in relationship to the stories that we tell about who we are and so forth. Because sometimes, at least around me and for me, it's like a discovery to kind of separate the, you know, I mean, it's what Keegan talks about as self-authoring, or like, but to separate the story from how it is, that like I can frame things that happen to me in different ways, or shine lights from it from different aspects, and then they feel different in terms of the stories. But with the relationships, I mean, it's not hard quoted, but it's definitely deep habits, how I relate to people and like what's possible in those relationships. That's been like a longer journey to start to shift or wiggle in. I don't know if what comes alive with you. I don't have a question particularly, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's that's the fundamentals of everything, really, isn't it? It sort of reminds me of that quote that we don't see the world as it is, we see the world how we are. Because it's like when you think about, okay, so who am I to me? But I am also you, because I am, when I'm with you, I am to you, your reflection of me, right? Your interpretation of me based on your own programs and lenses and biases and expectations and thought processes and experiences, right? So I see me through my lens, but you see me through your lens. And therefore, our relationship with others is really based on our relationship with ourselves. And actually, a lot of the work that I do is around that, helping people to self-discover, helping people to turn up the volume on their inner voice, their inner story, their inner, their inner life, in a sense, that inner sense. So that they can understand as well, that awareness that whatever I'm projecting on you, however I'm defining you from my perspective, is based on how I see you and see the world. This is why we all have such different relationships with the same people. And as I said before, this becomes the story of your life. So essentially, human beings are these kind of trigger machines, right? We walk around and we interact with the world through a series of triggers, you know, like our daily day. And actually, the more you can, for me, this is somehow the fundamentals of kind of dissolving some of our biggest challenges, is being able to become aware of the triggers, and that this isn't something that other people are doing. This is how I'm reacting to the world based on my previous experiences. And of course, this is chemical reactions. This is based on, you know, previous experiences and how we reacted to it and how we learned to behave and respond. But the more we can become aware of that, the more we can kind of distance ourselves from the response versus that deeper connection, where we can really start to see somebody for who they actually are versus how we project them to be or perceive them to be, perhaps is a better word. And I think if you don't take the time or the effort or the work, essentially, because it's kind of unlearning, unraveling, then, you know, life becomes a response to your existing programs. And if that's working for you, perfect. But for most of us, it's not always working in our favor, right? We struggle with it. We have what I refer to as this sort of chronic dissatisfaction. I should also say that part of it is our innate human state, because it's survival mechanisms of that sort of threat responses. And it's sort of using our evolving brain, well, not so evolved brain, actually, like our original brains, to live in a very evolved world where the fears and threats that were, I mean, of course, you also still have real threats, but a lot of us are responding to just things that are not really that threatening, but they threaten our ego, they threaten our kind of status or our, you know, need to be right or need to be important. And those are all innate human needs, because we need to belong, we need to be part of the group, we need to, and therefore we need to be right. We need to show that we're worthy to be valued and to be part of the collective, the group, or even outshine the group so that we don't risk being eliminated or removed. And so a lot of it comes from, you know, our sort of innate biological makeup as a survival mechanism. And that's where we need to use our kind of conscious awareness to be able to put some space between the innate reaction response and what is actually more conducive here, like what is helping me to build a better relationship, or what is helping me to solve the situation, whatever it is that's going on, like what's more useful than rather than that just mm-hmm. reaction. A lot of it also is based on traumatic experiences, or in sort of inverted commas, because obviously it doesn't have to be severely traumatic, but just previous experiences, let's say. But yeah, it's super interesting because essentially, I work with corporates now, and it almost always boils down to that. You know, when organizations have challenges with engagement or driving revenue, sales, profit, whatever it is, it almost always boils down to the quality of their relationship or their ability to build relationships.
But say something more about that, because I think that's a really interesting. I mean, a lot of what you said could be soft or like personal development stuff. However you sort of position yourself on that. I think people that listen to this podcast are pretty comfortable with personal development generally as a thing worth doing, so to say. But I think it's interesting to what you just brought in, like in terms of like the quality of the relationships with corporates. Like how do you, where does it sit? Or like what would be the issues? Like when you clear away the rubble, what it seems to be, and you get to the relationships, like what would those questions or tensions be? How would you formulate them? Or like what would they sound like, those challenges or predicaments or conundrums?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because you can get there from so many different perspectives or so many different points, right? So let's say, you know, some organizations, they come and they're like, we want to do well-being. We need to manage stress. Or sometimes it's literally we need to tick the box of having a well-being program, because I read a study somewhere that employees value that, and therefore it probably will help our retention, and it will help me as an HR director when I do my end of year report. These are the things that we've done. And that's basically like for them, very often it's the start and the end of the conversation. Okay, send a proposal with some well-being activities. And for me, that's just the very initial thought on it. And then it sort of starts, okay, but why? You know, so what are you trying to achieve? And then once you start digging, we do a lot of diagnostic work as well with, you know, surveys and interviewing and, you know, finding out, because if you don't get to the root of where the struggles are, it's very difficult to get to the impact or to the outcome that actually creates change or creates shifts in behavior. So the need can be anything from, as I said, well-being. It can be from performance-related struggles, or it can be engagement scores that are not really that great. It can be that they want to drive sales, although typically they wouldn't come to an organization like mine for sales. However, they should, right? I mean, yeah. This is like, you know, that's where, because you can do sales training, which is great as well. I mean, all kinds of trainings are great. All kinds of development is great. But at the end of the day, if you haven't resolved the sort of those human conundrums that we were just talking about and those relationship fundamentals, then it's very difficult to build anything on top of nothing, right? And on top of a foundation that's not there. And once you start to learn about this, everything else becomes more impactful and has a bigger outcome. We approach it with this kind of topic of neuroscience because, A, it's evidence-based, it's fascinating, it's super eye-opening, but it's also something that even the most resistant people listen to, they seem to connect with, because it's difficult to argue with brain scan. It's difficult to argue with such fundamentals of science, especially when a lot of people that are, let's say, quite disconnected and are struggling, they tend to be more sort of open to sort of left brain logic, science, learning. So it's a great way to kind of to simplify the understanding of why it's important. You know, why is it that our brains make us do the things that it does? And actually, a thing that often comes up as well is this. So one of the things that we struggle with is, whose fault is it? Either it's mine, and this idea I don't like at all because it makes me doubt me as a human. So probably it's your fault. Actually, whoever's fault it is, I'm going to make it your fault, right? Because it certainly can't be mine. Then I have to put my entire self into doubt. So for sure, it's your fault. So it's the other, that sort of blame game that we do automatically, because it's much safer to blame others, to divert the problem away from us, right? But once you start to understand that the brain chemistry makes us behave and do and think and respond in certain ways, then maybe you can put a distance between, it's not actually my fault, but it's just a chemical reaction that I'm having that's happening inside my nervous system. And therefore, I can sort of take a sigh of relief that I don't have to blame myself like I did something wrong. It's just the way that, you know, the chemistry is kind of forcing me to behave in a sense. And I feel like that helps a lot when to remove the ego from these conversations. And when I say ego, I'm talking more of that sort of the thing that we try to protect at all cost. That sort of the value of me. And when we can put a little bit of a distance there, it relaxes the mind. It removes some of that stress response, that defensiveness. And then from there, you're able to, get further because it's not defense anymore. And you literally, in a lot of our workshop, you sort of feel it dropping in these kind of aha moments. People are like, oh, okay, so that's really, I actually like this because it's not my fault, but I'm part of contributing to it. So now I can actually start to change a little bit my chemistry or be aware of, aha, I'm having a reaction here. But that's okay. We're all having reactions. Now, how can I take a breath and then think about a better way of responding or, whatever it is that helps to kind of bring us to a more productive place where, things can actually evolve, things can actually shift.
That's a really beautiful definition of the ego, what we try to protect at all cost. And then you said, the value of me. Because, the ego gets a bad rep, but it's there for a reason. Something that I've been curious about, and I see it a lot in different conversations, especially when it comes from this psychology field, this idea of the distance between something or creating that separation. And I don't know, I practice some meditation. I practice a bunch of different things. I've been, in therapy and coaching. I've done quite a fair amount of certain things and starting to feel like I have a bit of that fluency that you're describing that could come from not taking things maybe so seriously, not being so attached to it and so forth. But my feeling is, although the sort of the distance thing was useful as an image to start with, I felt like at some point it kind of got in the way. What I'm feeling right now is that I'm closer to the thing. It's almost more resolution, or I can see it at a higher. There are more things happening, I have an ability to pay attention to more of the different reactions or the different threads that are pulling me, or that the emotion consists of. So if I end up in a situation that's tricky and I get triggered, because I am still a trigger machine, then I can see that there are things that relate to one point in time, there's a quicker identification of the different threads that are pulling me. So I would say I almost got closer to the problem than a distance. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. And what do you think about that in terms of,
I think that's, well, distance doesn't necessarily have to be a space where we disconnect. If you're seeing the distance as let's disconnect from this emotionally and then try to get to a place where we can think about this logically, it's more about reducing the attachment to the trigger.
Yeah.
So it's, if you're able to, and it's not about reducing emotions for me. It's not about, being disconnected. So I kind of agree with what you're saying. It's kind of that courage of being able to even get closer to it, but not getting sort of what Eckhart Tolle refers to as the pain body, that kind of reaction that where we cannot operate through it. We're sort of blocked by the emotions, but where you can feel the emotions with curiosity, with compassion, with openness, ooh, I'm really getting triggered here. Maybe with a sense of humor, hello, trigger, and you know, being, and you can then get closer to it. You're in it, so I suppose it's just about the distance, the space, the gap. Well, however you picture that is kind of irrelevant. Sometimes it helps people to say, okay, let me take a breath, let me take a step back, because it creates that, okay, let me not respond to it so much. But if you're comfortable in the response, then perhaps you don't feel like, I don't need to take a step back because I'm perfectly comfortable being in it, and I can still operate from the heart, from my authentic self, from a logical place, from the other person's perspective with compassion. And then, you know, you're there. And I think meditation and mindfulness and these kind of self-discovering, I don't want to say self-reflective, because it's not necessarily about reflecting on anything. It's just quite the opposite sometimes. It's more about just stillness and being able to just be, are tremendously impactful. I studied even mindfulness and meditation in my neuroscience program, which is also kind of funny at the same time, that we have to take all these sort of ancient philosophies and then we have to put a neuroscience scan on it, and then we're like, ah, yes, see, this, now it works, now it's okay, you know, we accept
it.
So using those tools and practices can really help us to just raise the awareness, that acceptance of, it's almost like removing the shame of our reactions, removing the shame of the triggering, the responses, and everything is okay, in a sense. So yeah, it heightens your awareness. So I like how you describe it, like, you can see more because you have a heightened sense of awareness. So you don't miss anything, versus when you don't have the awareness, you don't see everything. You just notice a few things that pop up.
Yeah. And you kind of go on habit. Like, it's like, it's this type, this thing again.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
And then you know how you responded. And that could be like with, in a specific situation, or like with your mother or with your father, or like whatever. Like, it's just like the same response. And there are no other options than just going with the habit.
Actually those older relationships, they are our sort of best litmus test for how mm-hmm. far we've come on our journey. Mm-hmm. You go, oh, I'm so evolved now, I can handle anything. And then, mm-hmm. oh, maybe not.
Yeah.
Actually, even Eckhart Tolle talks, I'm a big fan of his work, and he even talks about it, how he needs to go into like a full-on meditative state when he visits family, because that's the only way that he can ensure that he's not responding just or reacting in that old programming. But it's okay. I mean, I think you just have to, I don't know, I always say, you know, you can bring humor into it, especially internally, and be like, haha, here you go again. But it's okay. It's part of human life, right? It's part of
I'm curious about these habits or responses, or like how we make sense of these things, like relating a bit more to the stories that we attach to these different halls of mirrors that we step into, or like these different emotional responses. And I mean, because you've lived in so many different countries and so many different continents, and now you're based in Middle East with a very different cultural history and very different sort of, I'm imagining, way of making sense of what's going on, actually. Like, what, from that lens, like, what have you discovered, or like, what are there important differences or similarities that look different from the inside, or like having experienced it rather than what you project on it, or yeah, I don't know exactly, but like cultural differences is what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is for sure, there are differences, right? With depending on, you know, if you're using like a lens, depending on if, you know, how far you zoom in or zoom out, you know, you see, you can zoom out all the way, then we're all very similar human beings, exactly the same biology and structures and chemical makeup and exactly the same emotions, very similar wants and needs in life, you know, our search for love and connection and validation and belonging and purpose and meaning and contribution. And, you know, that doesn't matter where you are in the world. And it doesn't matter where you are in terms of, you know, education, belief systems, you know, it's all the same. But then, of course, if you zoom in close enough, then even in, you know, I grew up in Vigbyholm, just outside Stockholm. So even if you zoom in to the four houses that were in a cluster where I lived, you know, the people were extremely different if you zoom in close enough. But certainly if you're an Emirati looking at those four families, you would be like, oh, they're almost exactly the same, right? So it all depends on how close you look. For sure, innately, we are always seeking for similarities because it makes us feel comfortable. You know, oh, you're like me because there's actually been some really interesting studies on this. Well, this is the whole concept of like in-group and out-group, mm-hmm. right, in psychology. And if someone's different than us and we struggle to find a similarity, then we consider them our out-group. And sometimes, you know, we see it now in the world, probably, I don't want to say more than ever because I'm not a historian or an anthropologist, so I, you know, there's probably been many times, but we see it now, we can observe it on a daily basis, looking around the news of the world, etc., where we are where we're focusing on our differences. A lot of it also, I mean, not to get too, a lot of it also comes from that sort of divide and conquer philosophy, right? If people are disagreeing, then they're going to be more focused on what I'm saying. And therefore you can have a better sense of control in a certain way. But, and it's very easy for us to disagree because we just have to focus on their out group. And therefore I have no compassion for them. I don't see them as the same value as people that are the same as me. And then all kinds of, you know, things happen from there. Even if you're taking in a workplace, if people are seeing themselves as different, then obviously you have a breakdown in communication because we believe less in what somebody from one of the out groups says. We agree less, we believe less, we relate less. But you can put someone in your in group through even like an exercise, like there was a study where they had to clean an area together. So they had to clean the floor and to do it together. And then after that exercise, they now started to see these people as our in-group. We are the ones that clean together. So we are now, we have that sense in common. This is where team building and connecting is so important because it puts you in that in-group. And as soon as somebody is in your in-group, you actually start to believe what they're saying more without questioning them as much. You also think that they're right more. You kind of agree with them more. So to sort of go back to your question, there's a great piece of work actually from Erin Meyer. I want to say her name is Meyer. Meyer, and she wrote this book or did research and wrote a book called The Culture Map. And it talks about the sort of nuances. She has like this framework where they look at different categories of measuring differences, and then learning, you know, how different cultures operate within these parameters. And it is really interesting because, for example, in communication, you have low context communicating cultures. And I think the United States is on like the most, the lowest context. Like what you hear is what it is. You know, it's very kind of, you don't need any further context to understand, because they say it as it is and it's clear. And then you have on the other side of the spectrum, the high context, like the Japanese, I believe, are, you know, some of the highest context communicators, where you really need to sort of read into and understand the context to be able to actually understand what they are referring to, or the nuances. And so these people from the different sides, if they're completely unaware of this, of course, we can clearly understand that there'll be lots of misunderstandings. And, you know, why don't they just say it as it is? We're like, why do they oversimplify everything? Why are they so blunt? Or, you know, on and on it goes. So, and I think living in Dubai now, I was running a workshop on this the other day, and it was really interesting to reflect on leading up to it. Because you have a lot of parts of the world where I've lived as well, like in the UK or in Canada or in the US, where there's a lot of immigrants, like lots of different cultures, but they tend to be, and in Sweden as well, but they tend to be sort of second, third, fourth generation that are now kind of integrated in that and has evolved almost to a new culture of that geographical place because of the sort of ongoing mix. I think here in Dubai, you have a lot of immigration that's like me. So I'm arriving, my parents don't live here. I don't have any kind of historical past here. I'm just literally an immigrant, fresh off the boat, as we say, like just coming straight in from my country into a new culture. And I'm here for a certain period of time for work, you know, to build my career, etc. And there's so many people like that, right? So you have kind of a rawer mix of cultures, because, you know, in Canada, for example, I was in Toronto before Dubai, you know, very high levels of immigration, wonderful multicultural city, but people are there, you know, their families are there. So automatically, the culture has been a little bit diluted, let's say, into where they are. Whereas here, everyone goes home for their holidays. Everyone speaks to their home countries, you know, after work, and they're constantly connected to the more different culture, let's say. So I think there is another level of sort of strong individual or separate cultures in a sense. Mm-hmm. But the beautiful thing with the UAE is that it's probably the most tolerant, accepting, open, loving, supporting culture that I've ever experienced. And because that is the sort of the native culture, everyone here fits in so beautifully, because you can be, you know, whoever you are, and everything is okay. We even have in Abu Dhabi, they opened a few years ago, this is called the House of Tolerance, and it has a mosque, a synagogue, and a church all under one roof. So it's, you know, really open and tolerant to all kinds of belief systems, even though their own belief system is a very strong pillar of their culture and their, you know, daily practices and how everything kind of works. There's that sort of openness, very love-driven in a sense, very accepting. So, yeah, to sort of go back to your question around, or your thought around you know, I think as long as you approach people with compassion, with tolerance, with openness, with acceptance, then you start to see the similarities. But as soon as you start to put up fear or judgment or we're right, they're wrong type of mindsets, then the differences become negative in a sense. And then you have that kind of breakdown in communication, in relationships, in society.
I think it's interesting because that's another aspect of, at least for where I'm at right now in my explorations, I'm thinking a lot about difference, but not the way that I see it is that if we can have difference and remain together, that's really exciting stuff. Like that's where a lot of creation happens. So like with tension or like being able to be with that tension, and like then it comes back to what we were initially talking about in terms of being able to, you know, be triggered, but be okay with the trigger and just like, okay, let's explore this trigger together and see what happened here. Like, let's get really curious about, you know, instead of saying, you know, because I mean, I have this sort of thing that I've been working with or a teacher told me is like, you know, you can collapse a relationship in different ways. You can kind of collapse the potential of a relationship, the creative potential, by being in complete agreement. If you just merge with the other person and say like, yeah, everything you say, it's just wonderful. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, you don't have any, then you're the same person and there's no real sort of exchange going on between you. You're just kind of moving together, you know, in harmony, very cozy. But, you know, what are you like, what this like feels like a loss of potential. And then on the other end, you can go like, oh, they're stupid, I'm never going to talk to them again, and like walk away. You know, and then again, like you've lost that potential of learning something or like moving further. And so this is something that I'm really focused on and looking a lot about. It's like difference, like what is difference that we can kind of use as an edge or a scaffold or like something that our mind hooks onto, like something that we see that we can use as a portal for, like the way I'm hearing you speak of neuroscience, like, yeah, sure. It's useful. It's a really useful perspective. It's great language to explain some of the things that we all know are going on. But it's almost like, I don't know, I'm projecting now, but it feels like you're holding it almost like a flip. It's not like evidence-based something, but it's almost like that's just an area of like, we can scaffold on or like attach to that area of evidence to like get to what we actually know, or like, you know, and eventually science will catch up, or like eventually science will get further and then we might know more, like, or something like that. Like we're using science, but science is a partial view of the world as well. So I don't know. That's why I'm also so curious about the differences of the cultures, because then it's like, well, it's fascinating, I find, to see like, do you see the world like that? Why? You know, oh my God, like, is that possible?
And, you know, and I think that the key word there, well, is curiosity and tolerance or compassion. I think one of my biggest kind of aha moments during my studies, and I even wrote at the side of my notes, like, wow, whoa, like what? I need to take a break because my entire world has just changed. And that was when I learned, and it sounds kind of ridiculous now, but it's okay to be comfortable with our own stupidity as well, or our own sort of lack of knowledge, right? Because of course, we simply cannot know everything and nobody knows everything. And actually, the more we know, the less we know, the more we realize that the less we know, right? So it was understanding that our eyes are not small cameras recording the world and, you know, 100% truth, but they are part of the brain and they are not seeing like a camera. They are interpreting like our other senses. And it's even now as I'm saying it, I'm like, no, it's a camera. I can see. I can see, you can see, we can compare. Like I'm seeing, you know, this, do you see this? Yes. Okay. It's, the truth. But of course, we perceive a tiny percentage of what actually goes on. That's another thing that can sort of freak you out when you realize that if I'm only seeing like a 0.01%, and I'm just making that number up, so don't quote me on that, but what on earth am I missing? What else is going on around me right now that I'm not even noticing, right? And so it was a huge sort of mic drop moment in a sense, because I then understood that I see things from my perspective using the filters in my brain that I have built up over my lifetime to perceive the world through my eyes. And you do the same. That means that from your perspective, you're right. And from my perspective, I'm right, even though those are different. And then I'm not saying that I have stopped trying to be right. It's an inherited trait. And, you know, yeah. It's also like an innate thing, as I said, that sort of sense of belonging. We want to be right because it proves that we matter, that we have something to add, that we're intelligent, that we're important, that we're valued. But it sort of helps us to diminish the disagreements, because we can start to accept perspectives and have perspectives be the guidance and not just my own perspective and my own right. There's a great, maybe you've seen it, sort of a cartoon where there's two people standing on either side of the number 6, which then of course appears number 9. And it's both correct, and they can stand there and argue till the cows come home, but they're both right. And I think we spend a lot of time doing that around differences. But if we could just go, maybe they saw it that way. You know, maybe that was how they saw it, which is great. And actually, I spend a lot of time now in this sort of new frame of mind, let's say, listening to people who have fundamentally different opinions than I do, even on difficult topics. You know, not to get into something specific around, but whether it's religion or politics or, you know, whatever it is, like strong, emotional, difficult topics. And I really try to listen to the other side. Sometimes it's quite scary to be like, wow, you know, they're so convinced in a way that makes sense, but it's so fundamentally different to my value system. And that can be difficult. But I think the more you practice being open to at least hearing people who have fundamentally different views on very difficult emotional value-based topics, the less, let's say, aggressive or sort of forceful, perhaps, we can be with our own perspectives. Having said that, there's of course, you know, fundamental moments where you have to be, I don't think you should always be accepting of other people's perspectives when it's harming you know, other people, or when it's creating suffering that's real for other people. So of course, you know, otherwise we could just be okay with anything. Like, oh, well, that's their perspective. Yeah, but you know, those children are getting traumatized or whatever. Like, yeah, but you know, that's their belief system. No, of course, you know, we have to be able to stick to our values, but at least having the curiosity to listen, to hear. And there's been many times where I realized that, yeah, I believe that because that's how I was brought up. That's how the culture where I come from, that's what we believed. I think actually Swedes can be quite high and mighty about certain ways that we believe things are. And I mean, I suppose everyone can be, but because we get a lot of credit, and sometimes rightly so, for doing things, you know, in the right way and, you know, having things sort of work out. So we get a lot of credit. We get recognized for, let's say, women empowerment and equality and all of these things as an example. So we can get a little bit arrogant, I suppose, about our own perspectives. But yeah, being able to listen with compassion, with understanding before making those judgments, I think is very helpful. And something that I see a lot here, people are by and large very open to listening, to understanding. Of course, the brain does this thing, right, where we might start off with a slight disagreement, or we form an opinion fairly quickly mm-hmm. about most mm-hmm. things. And then we go on the path of reaffirming that opinion. So we can sit at the dinner table and decide that we have different perspectives. And then I can grab my device and find lots of evidence to support it, because of course it's programmed to agree with me, because that's why I go back to use it, right? And yours is programmed to agree with you. The algorithms are supporting your perspective. So then we can debate for the rest of the meal about how we're right. And by the end of it, if we're not careful, over something that's not even that important, we can really have a negative opinion about the intelligence level, integrity, stupidity, or whatever of the other person, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is it's such a waste of time and energy. I mean, it can also be quite interesting. Don't get me wrong. I do love a good debate. But when it becomes then judgmental and then it can really become a waste of time, energy, a waste of a connection, of a relationship. But we do it quite easily as human beings.
I'm curious because of, I mean, what you said before in terms of Dubai being a melting pot of many different cultures, where it almost sounds like, or if putting my words on it, I almost heard you say like, well, no one belongs. So everybody's kind of, and because of that sort of, that creates an openness to maybe look at like, okay, what are the differences? Like, where do I have to really put down a boundary here? And like, what am I okay with? Like, it might be setting a lower bar for who are the good people, who are the bad people, who are these people? Like, you know, it's like, this seems to be like another, maybe you're shifting your boundary for who the others are, you know, a bit further by focusing on certain things and maybe letting other things go that don't hurt someone or doesn't harm you, or like, that, you know, like you can be okay with more and like don't have to be so firm in your mindset. I thought that's an interesting possibility that, and I mean, I feel it because we just moved from Sweden to Iceland because of about 2 years ago. And so it's very interesting to kind of both see Sweden from here, like, because a lot of things in the culture gets obvious. I mean, Iceland is still a Nordic country. It's still like on the surface level, it's quite similar. And then there are many differences that are very, also sort of significant. But then also to have to navigate a new culture and to try to make, like, get in and see that like some of my ways are so culturally conditioned and they don't work here. Like, so a certain level of the softness and the, like, there are certain things that are much more direct and I would say more Danish. that's my judgment here than compared to Sweden. So you have to modify and be curious about the codes and I can't be sure that I know what the symbols mean or like what a specific tonality or a specific, you know, opinion or whatever, what it means. Like, you sometimes be like, oh my God, we're fighting. And then the day after people are really happy and just like, okay, that's different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe that is in a sense the definition of tolerance.
Yeah.
I think, and I do a lot of work around that with clients too. It's around really honing in on your values. on your non-negotiables, you know, having very clear view of what your core values are, your totally non-negotiable values. And if you have clarity on that, then everything else is negotiable with ease, right? And then you don't have to waste time defending things as if they were your core value when they're really not. Because I think we do that a lot. We sort of get into arguments and defend things. And then 5 minutes later, we don't really care about it because we never really cared about it. But it was just this kind of, debate.
And I think there's also something around like the values being like, so if I'm in a situation where I can feel like we are clearly not aligned, you know, like whatever we thought we were going to do when we entered this meeting, that's not going to happen, you know. And initially, my habit would have been then to argue my point. And then it just turns into a useless meeting. Like, it's just
confrontation.
Know, and so, but instead I could like, either I could say like, hey, let's just stop this. Like, I'm not curious about what you have to say. So, you know, or which I tend to do more and more, I kind of find myself wondering, whoa, like I can learn, like, I'm not going to keep working with these people. I know that, but I can spend this hour understanding what they mean, you know? And sometimes like that seeking to understand type thing, you know, even though I might really disagree with them, like it does teach me something. Something becomes possible, or like I get to learn something that I didn't know from before. And at least like I know something more. Like, so there wasn't a generative discussion, and then there's nothing more than that. You know, I wouldn't, you know, I know where they are.
Yeah. I mean, you're not meant to be aligned with everyone. But at the same time too, and I don't know if you've notice that as well, when you've adjusted your approach to it, what tends to happen is that if you lead with curiosity and some compassion, some interest, they tend to drop their guard as well. Because when you're going at each other, that those kind of perspectives just get harder and harder and harder. But once you step back and create some space and show the other person that you're genuinely curious and interested and open to at least hear them, then sometimes you actually start to realize that you don't actually really disagree. You just started on the wrong foot and then became, you know, in a confrontation. And it happens a lot. I mean, it's one of the huge challenges also within workplaces, this constant disagreement or thinking that we're disagreeing, but actually it's just because we're approaching things with a lack of tolerance and compassion and curiosity and openness, and then you kind of end up in those, and then you get resentment, breakdown in communication, you avoid each other from then on, even though, and then the whole team work sort of disintegrates. So, you know, of course, as an individual, you can choose who you interact with, who you work with, who you don't work with. But within an organization, of course, you can still choose by, you know, moving on to another organization. But a lot of the time, we have to find common ground. We have to. And I think when you approach it in that way, most of the time, you find a way through. Not always. And that's again where those core values are really great.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what are we actually protecting? If we're just protecting what's essential, then that gives us a lot more space to be flexible as
exactly.
well. So it's like, but I wanted to kind of, because I know we're coming up to time as well. And I'm curious about one thing that you said early on, like this difference, or like the divide between the understanding and the knowing, or like the knowledge and like the deeper knowing, or like knowing almost pointing at the heart or some wherever that sits, but the sensory or like this intuition aspect, how does that live in you? How does that this sort of dialogue live in you right now, between what's proven in this Western scientific sense and what you know in the intuitive sense? Where does that conversation live?
Yeah, I mean, the most epic moments, in a sense, is when you have an inner knowing and then you find a research study that supports it. And you're like, yes!
Yeah. That's confirmation bias. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly, colliding up there. Now it's definitely sure.
Yeah.
I think it takes a lot of courage to, I mean, it's one thing to listen to your intuition and have it as a sort of barometer or a guiding force. And then, because it's somehow it's safer to be able to pull up a research study and say, well, it's been proven here. And not just that it's mm-hmm. safer, but it sort of fits into the construct of the world that we've built, right? We really value our brain's capacity to understand, to test, to show evidence. And you can argue that unless you can prove it, it doesn't exist, or it's not true. It's not real. But then you also have to accept that our brain is the only capacity for understanding that we have. And that to me doesn't feel complete. And when I say feel, I mean feel. That doesn't feel like I... It almost feels disappointing to think that, oh, it's only with our brain that we can understand the world. Surely not. But I think it takes a lot of awareness to hear it, to be able to listen to it. But it takes a lot of courage to act with it, because you don't have the scientific justification or the sort of the full evidence debate. Having said that, I think most people, they like the science, they understand it, but they really resonate with the knowing. Mm-hmm. And if you can find people where you kind of know together, this is really what kind of brings that connectedness, that cohesiveness of the oneness, the energy of humanity and the universe, or however you define that. You know, some people, you know, put a religious definition to it. Some people put a spiritual hat on it. Some people put an energetic sort of sense to it. And that's, you know, that's each to our own way of defining it. But I think we all kind of know certain things. And when we talk about that, when we can connect over the topics that we really feel that we have a sense of knowing, there's a much deeper connection that is made there than just the purely intellectual or cognitive or sort of logical connection. So I really, even though they're kind of conflicting, not kind of, they are actually very conflicting, in the sense that, you know, if I was to write about what I felt in a scientific paper, it certainly wouldn't get published. then it's more, you know, philosophical. But there's a lot of value in that. There's a lot of. I think the world would be very dry without that innate exploration.
But there's really a. It's something too. I mean, part of what we were talking about before as well is kind of a, I mean, whether we call it distance or whatever it is, but it's, we do something so that we can stay there, like remain there, like and keep exploring whatever we're looking at, you know? And of course, like in some in some particular situations you need to get out of wherever you are. But often you can stay much longer than you think. And so then it almost like that would be the argument for like the sort of almost the aesthetic aspect of knowledge. Like when you have these, like what mathematicians would refer to as these like these beautiful formulations or like this beautiful equation, and then people spend years to prove it or whatever, like the stuff that comes through before it's proven, like some of those like fundamental physical stuff that's just like where the, you know, it's like, I don't know why it works, but it works, like that type of stuff. And that's like to argue where that's birthed from, like where it comes from, I don't know, but like, I don't know if it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, like, well, whatever it was, like, it was one of those like really important physical, like that have definitely been like that. So, I mean, it happens all the time, even to scientists. Like, it's not just indigenous peoples or like yogis or gurus or whatever. And then, of course, you're saying like, then it's more philosophy, but, you know, even the Greeks, like, they had philosophy and science were intertwined.
Yes.
Like both the actual observation and the observation of the observer, and like all of those things were recursively building upon one another and equally, or not, maybe not equally, but more or less, you know, important, at least.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, they have to be. And I think, and maybe it's again back to this point of like, I'm right, you're wrong. You know, if you're a scientist, you know, then you discredit the philosopher or the more intuitive mindset, let's say. And if you're an intuit, then maybe you discredit the science. But it's really about the curiosity of where those worlds meet, I believe. And it seems it resonates, right?
Yeah, it's what you were saying with the eyes, like they are not objective things that capture everything and that report everything, sort of object, you know, it's like that gorilla thing, like when people pass basketballs between them, the gorilla walks over, and like as long as you're counting the passes, there's like very few people that see the gorilla.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, when you just look at it, you're like, oh, there's a gorilla. You know, oh,
how
my
could
God.
I have missed that?
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's the same in like witness statements and all kinds of reaccounts of the past. They did this studies where they showed pictures of somebody's life, and they put in some pictures that were created. So there's a picture of, let's say, you in a hot air balloon. You've never actually been on one, but you've now seen a picture of your life where you're in one, and now you start recounting the day when you went on that hot air balloon, and you remember it as if it actually happened, but it never happened. No, it's, and I think we give way too much credit to our memories, our the clarity of our mind. And we spend the majority of our lives arguing about these things when actually probably we shouldn't take it so seriously because it's very fleeting. And this realization really helps people to reconnect in a different way without having to, you know, see the world so right and wrong and black and white. And, you know, it's a thing that kind of brings us back together. In a sense. And I think that's more important now than ever. Well, it's always important, but we're here now. So for us, it's more important now than ever because it's all we have.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's why they call it the present.
There you go.
Because it's a gift.
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful place to work from because there's openness, there's love, there's flow, there's you know, tolerance, connection, all of those things that make us feel warm and fuzzy come from there. So it's a great place to sort of start your perspective from. Of course, we have to constantly bring ourselves back because we wander off on, you know, different tangents of, you know, proving ourselves or whatever it is. But if we can all kind of focus on coming back to that place as often as possible, that's a good place to start.
That's lovely. That's a good place to start. And it's perhaps also a good place for us to press pause and
exactly.
If people want to find you work with you or find your engage with your interact with your work, where do they?
Yeah, so LinkedIn is quite good. Maria Hago is my LinkedIn. I have a website, transform8now.com. But even through LinkedIn, you can find your way there. I'm always open for random communications and messages, as you know.
Exactly, like this one. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always curious, always open. I very often say, yes, let's chat. Because many wonderful things have happened from that place of, sure, yes, why not?
Yeah. So lovely. I have both of the links. They're clickable in the show notes as well.
Okay, sure, yeah.
The person that's curious, they will be there. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
The conversation.
I really enjoyed the conversation.